Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
2 years from today exactly, we are going to have a different person to kick around when things are going badly. So, with the clock ticking down, what does the president have in store in that little speech he's going to give? The State of the Economic Union on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 20th of January. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. There is nothing in the Constitution that says it has to be a speech, just that the president has to, from time to time, give the Congress information of the State of the Union. But a speech it has become. The latest iteration, as you know, is tonight, President Obama's sixth. Marketplace's David Gura is in our Washington bureau covering the speech for us. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so let's take this from where the president sits, right? The economy, according to the White House, is doing pretty well, yeah?
Yeah, and definitely better than it was the last time he gave a State of the Union and the time before that. I think, you know, what he can be proudest of and what he's probably going to point to tonight is the job market. And last month, the economy added 252,000 jobs. The unemployment rate is at 5.6%. These are good metrics, metrics that the American people like. And, you know, if you dig a bit deeper, we're seeing better jobs now. We're seeing more jobs available across the board and across the country. I'm sure he's going to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I mean, surveys indicate Americans are starting to feel better about the economy. The president's probably going to play off of that. Consumer confidence is up. And as one economist told me today when I was talking to him, it feels like we are out of crisis mode.
Being out of crisis mode does not, however, mean we are completely free and clear. There are still some trouble spots, right? Run those down.
That's true. So wages is a big one. Wage growth is something that the White House is still very focused on. Also, housing. Housing market has done better. It is doing better. But if you look at something like construction of single-family homes, there's still some room to grow there. And, you know, there's a lot of concern about the fiscal side of things, what the Fed's going to do with interest rates. So that's on the horizon as well.
You know, so, David, the president's been out on the road for a couple of weeks talking about this thing. I mean, there's nothing we're going to see tonight that he hasn't already talked about. What do you imagine will be the couple of things that he will be concentrating on as he sort of rolls this speech out across the country?
Yeah, he's mentioned a number of very populist proposals at speeches across the country. So he's focused on calling upon Congress to offer paid parental leave, for instance. He introduced a new tax reform plan that sort of focuses on capital gains, so something of concern to the very wealthiest of Americans. You know, I was struck as he gave these speeches by how much he's focused on what the administration's done already. And its hands have been tied mm-hmm. over these last few years. He hasn't done a lot with Congress. So, you know, a lot of what we've heard, giving more money for infrastructure, giving more money for putting broadband in rural parts of the country, these are things that he's talked about a lot. I don't expect he's going to stop talking about them. I think he's hoping that Americans' appetites for things like that will grow now as the sort of baseline improves, as more people have jobs, as there are, you know, fewer people who are worried about just paying their bills. We'll see what happens. Again, he has to work with a Congress now that both houses are controlled by Republicans. He's got his work cut out for him.
Just because this is the way things work now in Washington, do you think there is enough in this speech that will get some kind of real negotiations going, or are we just whistling past the graveyard, as it were?
I was on the phone this morning talking to folks about that. A lot of political scientists, a lot of economists think that we will see a return to what's called regular order, that we will see Republicans pass a budget. But those same people I talked to were very skeptical that this is going to be a starting point, as the White House hopes it will be. I mean, I think that this will be a starting point for conversations about tax reform and budget issues. You know, I think that's a much heavier lift for the White House. I think that the Republicans have their own starting point that they're going to want to get things started from.
Is it fair to say, David, that the president now has his eye firmly on his economic legacy?
Yeah, of course, the president has a lot on his plate. But as I said, he's had to spend so much time when it comes to the economy focusing on that unemployment rate, getting it down lower and getting month after month the number of jobs created to go up. This is an opportunity for him to do more, I think, as he sees it. And as you say, there isn't a whole lot of time left. So he has to be thinking about what his legacy is going to be down the line. And I think that this is a way for him to make that imprint going forward.
Marketplace's David Gura on the president's speech coming up tonight. David, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kai.
Don't watch that speech all by yourself. You can always just watch it with us. David's going to be live tweeting from inside the House chamber tonight. I will be there as well on Twitter. That is not in Washington. Full coverage at marketplace.org and on the Marketplace Morning Report at the crack of dawn tomorrow before the crack of dawn in a lot of places, actually. One thing that we didn't get to, David and I, was the global context for the president's speech tonight. In a word, my fellow Americans, it's lousy. This week, the International Monetary Fund revised its global growth forecast down, as did the World Bank last week. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that slice of the story.
University of Chicago economist Austin Goolsbee headed the President's Council of Economic Advisers until 2011. Here's how he'd describe the state of the economic union for his former boss.
Growing decently well. It's not growing great.
And still, we're the bright spot among developed countries. Just look at the other guys.
It's certainly a scary world. Europe is absolutely in the dumps. China's had a pretty steep slowing.
Plus, many developing countries are suffering from low oil and other commodity prices. But the global economy's interconnected, right? How can we do well if the rest of the world is sinking and not buying as much of our stuff? Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics says the U.S. is big and relatively insulated.
Exports are a fairly small part, 11 or 12% of U.S. GDP. And within that, the U.S., its main trading partners are actually Canada and Mexico, which have actually been doing quite well.
But as decently as the U.S. is growing right now, it's not enough, says Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute. Long-term unemployment's still high. Millions are so discouraged they're not even looking for work. Plus,
wage growth has been flat for a long time. And until we see employment rates pick up and wage growth accelerate, we still have a lot of recovering to do.
Those complaints are shared by economists, politicians, and workers in most of the developed world. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A bit of to-ing and fro-ing on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Irony, thy name this Tuesday is Delta Airlines. The carrier reported fourth quarter earnings today, and despite an operating profit, that is the actual moving of people in airplanes, Delta wound up losing almost $700 million all in last quarter because its fuel contracts, its hedges, overshot the falling price of crude. A lot of energy traders and banks, though, are betting that their luck might be better or that maybe they're just smarter than Delta is. They are buying up cheap oil in the hopes that they will be able to sell it later on at a tidy profit. That, of course, does leave them, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, looking for a place to park it all.
They call them VLCCs, which stands for Very Large Crude Carriers. These are super tankers capable of shipping millions of tons of oil in one delivery. And normally that's what they'd be doing, except no one wants to ship oil right now when the price is so low, which means you use them for the next best thing, storage.
The kind of super tanker stockpiling tends to accompany an oversupply in the market.
David Hunter is an energy analyst at Schneider Electric. The cost involved to rent these tankers and still turn a profit tends to eliminate all but the biggest players.
So it's not necessarily just oil companies. I mean, banks did this as well back in, after the financial crisis back in 2009.
Hunter says the cost to rent one of these ships just to stay put is about half what it is to transport, about $30,000 a day. Omar Nakhta is an analyst at Clarkson Capital Markets.
And so there's a bet that a lot of traders are making that, hey, I can book a ship and pay half the going rate and at least make some money trading it.
The price of crude is starting to trend upward. Some forecasts show by as much as $8 a barrel more by the end of the year. Nakhta says even then, cashing in isn't certain.
You know, right now it's still a gamble or you're playing for peanuts.
Nakhta says potential profits typically range in the cents per barrel, but when you've got a ship capable of carrying 3 million tons, you can still see a payday. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
2014 was a very, very good year for Christie's. The auction house said this morning it sold $8.4 billion worth of fine and decorative arts last year. You can be sure Sotheby's is going to come right around there as well. There are new CEOs at both of those companies, and with just those two big houses at the tippy-tippy top of the high-end art auction pyramid, the competition to sell top-dollar art is heating up quite a bit. Sally Herships has the story.
imagine a market where deals are completely unregulated, insider information is the norm, and sales are for millions of dollars. But you don't have to imagine, because it's real. It is the high-end art auction.
$80 million, and $80 million, $85 million, and $85
A painting by artist Francis Bacon has broken the record for the most expensive artwork ever auctioned.
$100 million, thank you, sir.
The high point of the sale, the flag, painted by Jasper Johns in 1980.
The business side of the high-end art world is dramatic. But listen to how art ends up at an auction house in the first place.
Death, divorce, and debt.
Drama. That's what forces people to sell their $100 million oil paintings. David Nash is co-owner of the Mitchell Innes and Nash Galleries in Manhattan.
What is this that we're looking
at? This is a sculpture by Jean Arp. It's called Torse Gerbe.
He used to be the head of the painting department at Sotheby's. He worked there for 30 years. So he knows the auction world can also mean drama for the staff.
It was pretty high pressure when I left. Now it's 10 times worse. As soon as you've had one $400 million sale, you've got to take the phone call the next morning for the next one.
Remember, there are only two players at this level. That means there's often an auction before the auction, when the two houses are bidding against each other, offering better deals to try to land the customer. Say a collector is interested in selling a painting by Francis Bacon.
And that Bacon is going to make a record, and it's going to be all around the world, and you both want it. How far are you willing to go to get something that you have to have?
Michael Plummer is a founder of ArtVest Partners. The company buys and sells and provides advice on the art market. He was COO of Christie's Financial Services and also worked with Sotheby's for years.
Same psychology in the auction room that puts two people bidding against each other to drive something up to $140 million is the same psychology that puts two auctioneers pitting against each other to get that piece to the auction itself.
It seems worth it, right? For either Sotheby's or Christie's to do whatever is needed to lock down a deal to sell a headliner work of art. But Plummer says it's not.
They just don't make the kind of money that you would think they do. When you see those hundreds of millions of dollars of sales, they're not bringing in the money that people expect that they are. And that, I know, is a shocking thing to a lot of people.
Even if you sell a $140 million painting, you may give away most of the commission to the client. Auction houses also offer guarantees, which can be a lot like gambling. The house will guarantee a minimum sale price, but if that sale doesn't go through, the house is stuck buying a very pricey piece of art. Plummer says one of the problems Sotheby's is facing is too much focus on high-end sales, the kind that often come with a guarantee. And here's where this can get a little confusing. Both auction houses also say they're coming off of 3 years of record-setting sales.
So if times are good, why get rid of the leadership?
Well, you know, making a change, I wouldn't say getting rid of, making a change is easier when times are good.
David Chick is a luxury industry analyst at Stifel, an investment banking firm. He says transitions to new personalities and ideas are just easier when a business is doing well. And both Sotheby's and Christie's say the last few years have been record setters, at least as far as sales go. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You could maybe even guess, and you would end up with $2.2 million. And that is life-changing.
Yes, it would be. Game shows on our series, I've Always Wondered. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ticked up a fraction of 1% today, just 3 points, closed at 17,515. The NASDAQ gained 0.4%, 20 points, finished at 4,654. The S&P 500 up a 10%, 3 points there as well, 2022. Tech stocks were the bright spot. Apple, Yahoo, and Micron Technology all climbed more than 2%. Netflix up more than 3% before the bell. And then after the bell and a strong earnings report, the company soared more than 13%. Airline shares also flying higher thanks to those dropping oil prices we talked about. American rose nearly 6%. Delta, despite that hedge fail we told you about, lifted 1.8% higher today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.78%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
from the Marketplace Statebook. Here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Mayors gather in Washington, D.C. for the 83rd U.S. Conference of Mayors winter meeting. Vice President Joe Biden is slated to speak later in the week. The Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for December. And the annual World Economic Forum gets underway in Davos, Switzerland. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Employees at a growing number of companies have gotten a high-tech add-on to their health insurance plans this year, one that uses data from their smartphones or health tracking wristbands. It's all thanks to a startup that is trying to answer two age-old questions. What if your health insurance got cheaper as you got healthier? And also, isn't there an app for that? Marketplace's Stan Alcorn has the story.
The startup is called PACT, and it began as a fitness app based on behavioral economics.
PACT gives you cash rewards for living healthy, paid by the members who don't.
Go for a run, log it with your Fitbit, and the lazier members put a couple bucks in your account. Now, the app has spawned an employer-based health plan. Your company pays instead of those couch potatoes, and the money goes toward your out-of-pocket health care costs. Here's PACT CEO Yifan Zhang.
It basically turns your health insurance deductible into what we call a smart deductible that adjusts with every workout.
Employees who log workouts every other day could see their deductibles drop by nearly $1,000. But what, besides a bigger share of your next hospital bill, does the employer get? Nick Francis is the CEO of Help Scout, one of the first companies to use the PACT health plan.
We make software, so our employees tend to spend 8 to 10 hours a day sitting down. They're not getting very much exercise.
To Francis, the health plan is less about economics than encouraging health for health's sake. But that could add up to tangible savings, according to PACT, if fitness-crazed employees stay out of the hospital. This, according to C.C. Connolly of PricewaterhouseCoopers Health Research Institute, is the economic force driving the health app explosion.
Employers, the government, individuals are all looking for ways to hold down rising health care costs.
But she also says the evidence that there's an app for that is still lacking. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Not long after New Year's, NASDAQ, the stock exchange, announced that it had bought a company called Dorsey Wright, which does data analytics and a bunch of other inside baseball market stuff. The deal served to remind that the NASDAQ and a lot of other exchanges are more than just places to buy and sell stock. NASDAQ is a publicly traded company whose shares are listed on the NASDAQ, which is very meta if you think about it. But how do these companies make money? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is on that one.
Back in 2003, NASDAQ was losing money. Most of its revenue was tied to the thing that we all know it for, stock trades. Exchanges typically make a small amount on each sale. But how much people trade? James Engel says that's largely out of the exchange's control. He's a professor at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
You don't wake up in the morning and say, oh gosh, I want a bunch of trades. You say things like, hey, I want to buy some Exxon. Or I want to sell some Tesla. So the trading demand is really derived from demand for other stuff in the economy.
And there's now lots of exchanges where companies can list or investors can trade. Dan Weaver is a professor of finance at Rutgers.
It's no longer the New York Stock Exchange is the premier or NASDAQ is the premier exchange. It's who's going to charge me the least. I don't care who they are.
So in recent years, NASDAQ, like many exchanges, has tried to diversify, developing new products and revenue streams, merging with and acquiring outside companies.
We operate in four key areas: list, then trade, intel, and tech.
Adina Friedman is a president at NASDAQ. She says the company makes money selling data, including information about the trades on its platform. It also sells its software to places like the Hong Kong Derivatives Exchange and many exchanges in the Middle East.
We really are a technology company ourselves.
Of course, NASDAQ still makes money when companies list or when stocks trade. But today, Friedman says that's only about half the company's revenue. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We've got a thing we do every now and then on the program. We take your questions about stuff you've never understood about business and the economy, and we answer those questions in a segment that we call I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Today's question comes from Matthew Morris. He lives right here in Los Angeles.
I've always wondered how game shows get their prizes, you know, like the Winnebagos on The Price is Right or the money that they pay out for Jeopardy. How does that happen?
As it happens, we've got just the person to answer that for you. One of our producers, Josh Wu is his name, was on Jeopardy as a kid. He solved the bonus puzzle on Wheel of Fortune, and he took home The Price is Right showcase 5 years ago today. So here he is.
The best place to start in a quest for answers about game shows just might be a bar.
Yes. Oh, I know that one then.
O'Brien's in Santa Monica, California, to be exact.
I won just short of $500,000 on Jeopardy.
I won $25,000 on Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Every Wednesday is bar trivia night, and a lot of former game show champs fill up a lot of the bar stools here.
I won $2,100 on Joker's Wild back in 1974.
That's Dan Avila. He's been on 8 game shows, and one of those appearances was a historic one.
He's going for the largest cash prize, as far as we know, in the history of television.
It was 1999. The show was Greed. Dan had won $200,000, and he made a decision to bet it all.
To me, the $200,000, it's not life-changing. But I decided that you could maybe even guess, and you would end up with $2.2 million. And that is life-changing.
For $2.2 million. Is it tuna? Oh, dang.
But what would have happened if Dan had won? How does a show shell out that kind of cash? Art Alisi is the president of Promotional Considerations Incorporated. They handle prizing for Wheel of Fortune. Art says each television network sets aside some money.
They may give him $50,000 a week for their prize budget. And then they have to generate the rest of the money, so they have to use the fee spots.
Fee spots are those little ads at the end of the show that follow this announcement.
Promotional consideration provided by...
On Wheel, they pay up to almost $15,000 for that spot for 10 seconds. There could be 3 of them at one time. That means $45,000 for a 30-second spot, and that brings them the extra revenue that they're looking for.
So what about prizes?
How about a new toaster and stylish leggings?
You probably think game shows trade those 10-second spots for stuff. And sometimes they do, especially one kind of prize.
Rudy and Stacy, grab your shades. You're headed to the Sunshine State. Experience
trips. Adam Neediff used to be a prize coordinator.
I was something of a telemarketer on behalf of Wheel of Fortune.
He says he would call up hotels and say, hey, I'll give you a 10-second commercial in our show.
And all you have to do is just let us have this free stay in your hotel for 7 days and 6 nights.
But what's surprising is a lot of times, game shows just flat out buy their prizes, especially...
A new car!
Art Alisi has been in the TV biz for 50 years, and he says shows used to trade ads for cars, but then along came The Price is Right. They give away a car 3 times a day, so they started buying them so that they would have the stock to keep up.
So the people said, why should I be giving you free cars when I can go on Price is Right? And they'll buy the car. So now we have to buy the cars.
Alisi says there's an easy way to tell if a prize has been bought or traded for. Just listen to how it's described.
When they say you won a set of Goodyear tires from the number one store, Goodyear, then you know that was promoted. If they just said you won a wonderful set of rubber tires, they bought it.
There is one more way game shows keep their prize warehouses full.
A lot of the prizes are forfeited. When you forfeit a prize, it goes into their inventory. So they could always promote it again since they already own it and give it to somebody else if they want to.
But why would anybody want to do that? Well, back at O'Brien's, Dan Avila paints a pretty good picture.
I was on a show called Sale of the Century, and one of the prizes I won was $600 worth of women's shoes. That was all I got. I didn't win any cash.
But did you have to pay taxes out of pocket for those?
Yes. As a matter of fact, you can turn down the prizes because you are taxed at their value.
Every time you win, Uncle Sam wins too. And if you didn't win any cash to cover it, you're basically just buying stuff on clearance. But the guys who come out week after week to O'Brien's don't play trivia here for the $100 in bar credit. It's just fun. And the same goes for game shows. Just ask tonight's quizmaster and Jeopardy! College champion, Cliff Gallagher.
I think I'm one of the few lucky people who converted thousands of hours of studying into what probably comes out to minimum wage when you consider how much I won. But it's still probably the most money I'll ever make in a day. So, yeah, if there are any other games out there, count me in.
In Los Angeles, I'm Josh Wu for Marketplace.
If you've got a question for us, you know where to go, marketplace.org. Send it right along.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the observation that crude oil closed down almost 5% today, $46 and change at the close in New York. But that's not what I wanted to tell you, actually. What I wanted to tell you is that gas is under $2 a gallon in more than half of the states. And also this, according to the Oil Price Information Service, gas at an average of $2.50 cuts in the aggregate $120 billion from the amount that we all will pay for gas at the pump this year, which is kind of amazing. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up a fraction of 1% today, just 3 points. The NASDAQ gained 20 points. That is 0.4%. The S&P 500 put on a 0.1%. That is 3 points. Caitlin Esch and Millie Jefferson are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Madhavan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.